Hi there, and greetings to everyone seeking and hoping to find the true meaning of life, those sick and tired of this poisonous world whose soul and spirit are bleeding, and of the emptiness and futility of this materialistic civilization. Welcome to our radio show, The Way, The Truth, The Life. Welcome to our world of supreme love and immortality, where all human hopes are fulfilled. Welcome to the world of Orthodox Christian spirituality, a world now unknown to the West, which once had the key, but lost it a long time ago, the key that has an answer to every question. My name is monk Arsenije Jovanović. I live in the monastery of Ostrog, Montenegro. It is never too easy to talk on spiritual issues, especially when it has to be in foreign language, which is English to me. I apologize in advance for possible mistakes. However, I believe God will help me to say the word and you to understand it. So, let us embark on our waves. Good evening, dear listeners. Now, after a pretty long period of time, I'm addressing you again. And this time I was lazy as usual and I didn't record my own presentation, but I have overtaken another presentation, which we will broadcast tonight. It is a speech given in Sydney, Australia by Father Rade Radan, who is priest of Serbian Orthodox Church in Australia, and he's serving in his parish in Sydney. So the name of presentation is Mass Media and Today's Youth. I hope and I believe that you will enjoy Father Radan's speech, which is full of inspiration for our today's life on this very modern and very important issue.
Yes, I offered him a few suggestions, but he didn't take me very seriously, of course. And being as expeditious as he can be when he wants to, he's not often expeditious. He gave up on my ability to decide for myself, so he made a decision for me, and he emailed me tonight's topic, leaving me no other options. And so it was that whilst I was on my travels through China and Serbia and Greece, I thought at times, not often, but I thought long and hard at different times about various aspects of the vast subject he had gifted me. So here we are at the beginning of Holy Week to share our thoughts and understanding on the subject of mass media and our youth. Tonight's topic is somewhat unfortunately formulated. Mass media sounds a little bit frightening. You know, the word mass always conjures up images of mass graves and mass protests and mass migrations, all that kind of thing, and then mass media just sounds like a terrifying, daunting prospect. And we'll see that it actually is. And the formulation, our youth, unfortunately, distinctly smacks of paternalism. And paternalism being for those of you who are a bit younger here, paternalism is a very judgmental attitude that people have, particularly people like us priests who think we know everything and we should teach you because we know best, right? So when we talk about our youth, there's this assumption that our youth knows nothing. Just the formulation, mass media and our youth. And really, our youth know a lot more about mass media, or at least the manifestation of mass media, than we can ever possibly, we geriatrics, could ever possibly want to assume. So, when we say our youth, it is as if those of us sitting here who are parents know that the mass media is a dangerous, controlling device, a weapon of the devil being unleashed upon the world. And as diligent, all-knowing parents armed with virtue, we take on ourselves the God-given task of saving our children from its corrupting effects. I'll contend that the mass media, that giant plague of information and misinformation flooding the globe, might not be all that bad. And I aim also to highlight that we as parents, or older folk, live in blissful ignorance of the enormity and the subtlety of the constant assault the mass media unleashes on society in general, and in particular on us humble Orthodox Christians. So exactly what are we talking about when we use the term mass media? What do you understand? What are the mass media? Who can give me some ideas? How does the mass media manifest itself in the world? Give me an example of something that belongs to that group of media called television.
Radio. What else?
Radio.
Radio.
Radio. Newspapers. Facebook.
Mobile phones.
Mobile phones. Okay. We've got billboards, pamphlets, all sorts of things that advertise something or other and want to deliver a message. Generally, something is being sold. Maybe not for money, but maybe it's not a product, but it's certainly an idea. Now, somebody mentioned Facebook here and mobile phones, and we often call things that are associated with that little device that probably all of us... Have you all got a mobile... Who has not got a mobile phone in their pocket? The under-sixes. And George is 80-plus. Okay, that's understandable. So, but generally we call the things that are appended to our mobile phone, we call them social media, because we access Facebook, Instagram, whatever things that you use, Father Miguel, because I don't use any of them. Just Facebook.
WhatsApp.
Yeah, actually, I use WhatsApp. Yep. Okay, and of course we can access the internet, our email, and all that kind of stuff, which is they're the things that I do. So, social media should be considered integral to the mass media, simply because whenever you or I author material that we send into the ether for other people to read, we are in fact publishing. And in this sense, we contribute to and become part of the mass media. Add to that the fact that publishers, newspapers, television shows, websites and bloggers all use social media to augment, to enhance their effectiveness in whatever it is they may be trying to peddle. It's important to understand that mass media is not an entity. It's not a body. It's not even a conglomerate of entities. The media are tools, and they are owned and directed by individuals and organisations. Rupert Murdoch has one such tool. Fairfax has one, and anybody with a Wi-Fi connection can have one too. Governments have these tools, and powerful corporations, whose activities are almost never restricted to disseminating information, also have these tools. The link between governments, corporations, and the media should never be considered accidental, nor should their interdependence be taken lightly. When you own a television station or two, or satellite networks in dozens of countries throughout the world, a vast array of major daily newspapers and magazines with accompanying websites, when cities are littered with billboards advertising your next blockbuster, life-changing, must-see season 7 of Desperate Housewives, when your newspaper is the major sponsor of the next major sporting event in the country, and you also own a major motion picture studio in Hollywood, politicians, that is, members of government, many governments, take a very keen notice and interest in your business activity. With all those tools at your disposal, you could wreak havoc on the functioning of a government. And because you agree not to do so, your government busies itself with passing legislation and bringing into effect various free trade agreements with third world countries. This allows your corporation to bring development to those third world countries, to help poor people build factories and develop industries, employing them as cheap labour and producing whatever it is in the world, whatever it is in the world that is needed in the way of products and services to make the world feel happy and worthy. This exploitation of human and natural resources throughout the world is called, what's it called? Globalization. Very good. 2 points. I'll just go back here because that was actually probably a bit complex. I was wreaking havoc on the computer writing this last night at some ungodly hour because I feel a bit like Che Guevara or some sort of communist insurrectionist, because people like Rupert Murdoch and people who own huge media enterprises do not exist on their own. They have it, if nothing else, they have the tacit approval of governments to do what they're doing. Because governments are scared of media groups. Why? Because they could just tear them to pieces whenever they felt like it. And of course, media groups do in fact, from time to time, tear certain people apart. They keep these things they call mud files, you know, some dirt that they may have on person A, B, C or D, and in conjunction with somebody in a ruling government or party who wants to get rid of somebody or other, they might bring the mud file out and cause havoc for that person and cause him to have to leave his position in government or in business or whatever else it is. Could even be in church. So, governments are wary of media organisations. And media organisations don't generally exist on their own. Media organisations are generally part of a big corporation. And these big corporations have a lot of money. And what happens is these big corporations go into poor countries. Countries like Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and now very topical at the moment is going into the countries of South America. And what they do is they exploit this incredibly wealthy workforce. There are millions of people living on the poverty line, and these countries are full of natural resources, be it coal, be it gas, be it oil, be it whatever else. Okay, so it's full of this. Or this poor population doesn't have a whole lot to do except grow vegetables or go fishing. And so they come along and they tell them they're going to make their life much better for them, so they won't need to go fishing every day. They'll be able to work in factories and earn money. And so they employ them, give them small amounts of money, and then they take these products and they sell them in affluent countries like the United States, Australia, or Western Europe. And they do this, how do they do this? They do this by getting the government, who's already scared of them, to endorse what are commonly called free trade agreements. Now, that's a euphemism. What's a euphemism? Who can tell me what a euphemism is, except for the Ludiger? He knows this word, but who else knows what a euphemism is? Okay, Ludiger, explain what a euphemism is.
Something which stands for something utterly different. It's like a false front, false image that's being put out there in order to cover something else. It says one thing, but it represents something else.
Correct. I'm going to give you 3 points. So, euphemisms are often very deceptive. They're very deceptive. We'll get into euphemisms in a moment. But free trade doesn't actually mean free trade at all. It's got nothing to do with when you have a free trade agreement with America or with Australia, that doesn't mean you actually trade. It doesn't mean you grow oranges over here and you as the grower of oranges or a company that's based in Brazil that grows oranges exports through some sort of agreement to Australia and that money goes straight back to you in Brazil. No, that's not what it is at all. One would expect when you talk about trade is I sell something to you and you sell something back to me. That's what trade's all about, right? we trade things in, we trade things over for one thing or another. But that's not what happens in a free trade agreement. A free trade agreement, being a euphemism, is actually a lie. It's not a free trade agreement at all. It's a contract that allows big corporations to go over to Brazil and grow oranges, employing these people and selling their cheap oranges to America or to Australia, and then the money that's generated from that, keeping it in America or Australia, and then using that for other purposes. So there's no free trade. It's actually a big myth. So I'm starting to sound a bit like a communist, I do apologise. Capitalism has gone to the absolute extreme in today's world. If you dig deep, you know, you'll see, you know, and we have no, as Christians, we don't endorse any political or any social organisation, except at times through history we've kind of played around with the idea that a monarchy is a great model. But we've never actually said that's the only model, and we've never actually said it is the must-have model either. But we've played around with various models, but we've never endorsed any of them. We don't endorse socialism, we don't endorse capitalism, because at the end of the day, poor people are being driven further and further into the ground. Now, that guy that I talked about who, in Brazil, no longer goes fishing, is like the chap. This is, you probably have heard this story. You know, there's an American entrepreneur that goes to one of these South American countries and he sees this Mexican fishing off the wharf. And he says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm fishing." And he says, "What are you going to do with that fish?" "So I'm going to eat it." And he said, "You know, if you took that fish to the market, you could sell that fish for 10 pesos, you know?" And he said, "Yeah, and then what would I do?" They said, "Well, you know, then you could come back and, you know, you could buy something a bit cheaper to eat than 10 pesos, and you could invest that money a bit. You could have that money here. And then you could go, you come back and fish, maybe buy an extra fishing line and have two or three fishing lines out there, and you'd catch three or four fish." And he said, "Well, then what would I do?" He said, "Well, you'd bring those fish and take those to the market, you'd sell them, and you'd generate more money." And he said, "And then what would I do?" "Well, you'd then buy more fishing rods, and then when the time came, you'd actually employ a couple of people to help you drag these fish out of the ocean." "And then?" He said, "Well, then you can buy, because you'd have this money from this sale of these things at the markets, you'd have this money and you could buy yourself a boat. And then you can go out into deeper waters and you can throw nets out into the water and you can bring in huge catches of fish. And then what would I do?" He said, "Well, you'd sell all those fish and you'd make lots and lots of money," says the American. Sorry, bloody good. And then he says, "And then what?" He said, "Well, you know, you just do that over and over again over a period of time, and then you could actually get a really huge boat, right? And then you'd be huge, catching enormous, unlimited quantities of fish and generating incredible amounts of money. And then what you could do is buy a fishing trawler and go out into the deepest, deepest oceans, and then you'd be making a killing. You'd be making a killing." He said, "And then what would I do?" He said, "We could employ all these people. You could have all these people working in administration, looking after your affairs." And he said, "And you could sit here and fish all day." He said, "I'm doing that anyway." Right? So, what's the point of going through that whole exercise? So, the exploitation of human and natural resources throughout the world is, as we said, called globalization. You'll notice that term isn't used that often anymore because it has achieved a sense of notoriety. It's not a very popular term these days. Now when we see spiels for big corporations and big companies, they talk about globalization in different terms. They use the term global village because that generates this feeling of, you know, it's global, it's like throughout the world, and it's a village, and it's lovely because we're in a village and it's all sort of whole earth and all that kind of stuff. And that's a subliminal effect that this has. People tend to think, it's the global village, isn't it wonderful? Right? So this is done deliberately to make the process of exploitation and economic domination sound a lot less frightening than it really is. Now, the use of deceptive language, or euphemisms, has become an art form in the mass media, and its effectiveness in sidelining an issue is frightening. Americans, sorry, Vladiko, are the most effective exporters of this ever-developing lingo, coining phrases such as the peace process, which you'll hear people like Hillary Clinton uttering this all the time. The peace process describes the decades-long spilling of blood that the USA has overseen in Palestine. And they call it the peace process. Nothing about it. There's no peace process at all. This is a complete fabrication, a complete lie. And then you hear another word, another phrase, reproductive rights. And that's used instead of using that really messy term, abortion. And then you have this thing called, very popular at the moment, quantitative easing. Now that almost immediately excludes three quarters of the population who think that's an economic term that I absolutely have got no idea ever being able to understand, so I won't bother. But what that actually means is the printing of money. So when a government like Greece or various governments in countries in Europe, when they're on the brink of financial collapse, they print money. I think Russia's doing that at the moment. But governments and economists and analysts, when they're talking about this, they're talking about it because it's not a good thing to do for the economy long term. Hitler did it and then, you know, initiated a terrible depression in Europe as a result of doing so. So instead of calling it printing of money, they call it quantitative easing, so that it removes that whole tarnish of, you know, and makes it possible for governments to do so without people ever really knowing what they're doing. And probably for us Serbs, and I think there are quite a few Serbs in the audience or congregation or in the pews, perhaps the most gruesome and the most chilling of all time is which one?
Merciful Angel. Merciful Angel.
No. It's nasty. It's not that bad. What's the worst euphemism you heard during the bombing of Serbia?
Humanitarian bombing.
No, that's bad. Collateral damage. 4 points. Collateral damage. Collateral damage, which takes the place of. So you can say collateral damage is just two simple words. What that actually means is the murder of innocent civilians whom we may have deliberately targeted in order to terrorise the local population. So instead of saying all of that, and that really is a terrible indictment on any democratic country, you call it collateral damage. And that somehow sanitises the whole process. So it's unfortunate, but, you know, it's a consequence of war. So manipulation of language allows the media to label combatants on either side in a conflict as either terrorists or freedom fighters, depending on how the picture needs to be painted. A phenomenal example of deceptive language or euphemism was when Hillary Clinton, in her, I remember seeing this and I was absolutely flabbergasted. She's one of the most loathsome, God forgive me for saying this in this holy house, but she's one of the most loathsome creatures that walks this earth. I don't know that a more nasty person ever drew breath, frankly. But she, in her pre-electoral campaign in America, and you know that's a big show, that's a big show in America. She was giving various interviews out to people and networks and whatnot. And she was talking about, because she has to portray herself as a heroine, she was talked about this moment when she flew into Tuzla during the war in Bosnia. And she said, you know, look, I remember, you know, getting out of that helicopter or that plane or whatever and coming up to these poor people, you know, and the bombs were going off all over the place and it was just terrifying and everything else. And of course, she painted this picture of being a heroine. Well, a couple of days later, somebody leaked out footage of her arriving in Tuzla, and she actually didn't arrive like that at all. She arrived and there were these young girls in national costumes and what, who presented her with flowers. There were no bombs. There was no war. There was nothing. She arrived in total peace. And then she had to answer this accusation of, well, how can you tell such a lie? And one of her what do you call those people that speak for you? A spokesperson. It was a spokeswoman, in fact. Came out and said, yes, the Mrs. Clinton did misspeak. She didn't misspeak. She lied. She lied. She misspoke. And she makes misstatements. Not only her, but others in the same field. So, depending on what picture you want to paint, you use the adequate, or rather the appropriate language. Not only that, but one thing that happened in 1999 is the man in the other grey cassock, Father Miodrag and I, we went to Serbia. This is very important because this will give you an illustration of how badly you can be misrepresented and how badly you can be maligned by the mass media. We went to Serbia ostensibly to try to persuade the authorities at the time, that was Slobodan Milošević's administration, to allow us to go in to speak to those two Australian care workers who had been jailed on suspicion of being, what were they? Spies, or being spell spies. And we were approached by 60 Minutes to go to take them over there to do this. So we went. And when we got there, we couldn't get to see Peter Wallace and
Stephen Pratt.
But I would.
5 points.
Very good. We didn't get to see them, and it just turned out that in those days, the Americans had decided, or they'd come to some sort of an agreement with the Serbian government, and there was going to be a ceasefire, and Slobodan Milošević was going to do whatever he had to do, and there was a resolution that was passed in the United Nations. It was 1024 or 1044 or whatever it was. 1224. And that was going to give NATO certain rights and whatever else. And so that happened, I think, on our way to Serbia. And we arrived on the last day of the bombing. And then several days later, we went to Kosovo with Richard Carlton and with his producer and with a sound technician and a cameraman. So there were three of them, and they found a driver, and we went down in a convoy with a whole lot of reporters down to Pristina. And when we got there, it was absolute chaos. It was total bedlam because there were hundreds and hundreds of media people who had come from Belgrade who wanted to be there when NATO was going to roll in and the Albanians are all going to come back from, supposedly from Macedonia and from Albania. And we arrived there, we went to the monastery of Rutanica, where we were smešteni. Where we stayed. These reporters, they stayed in this hotel, which was pretty awful. And then we were there for a few days, and we did a series of interviews with different people, and also they came out to the monastery of Rutanica to interview us, and they asked us these very difficult questions. And somehow or other, it's a long story, but somehow or other we managed to sort of get through these interviews in one way or another. We also went to Kazimestan, and we talked there about the Battle of Kosovo and all these other things. And then we were in Pristina when NATO rolled in. And all of a sudden, this myriad of Albanians appeared out of nowhere. They had been in the forests around here. There were countless thousands of them. I nearly lost my head. That's another story as well. That was because I was just really stupid. And anyway, we were there for a couple of days. I think it was a couple of days. And then we left. And when we were leaving the northern part of Kosovo, on our way to Kuršumlija, where Father Sasha is from, there's just this lonely road winding through these forests. And we were driving through there, and the journalist said to me, he said, ask the driver, why there's nobody anywhere? How come there's no one anywhere around? And the driver told me in Serbian that there were Serbian fighters on one side of this road and Albanians on the other, and they were shooting still, because this still had not been resolved. You know, NATO had come in as far as Pristina, up further up there were still incursions, and there were still, you know, guns and bullets and bombs and all that sort of stuff. And so he explained that to us, and he said to me, we can't stop here anywhere, it's very, very dangerous. And he was gunning it. He was a literal. And we're driving, and as we're driving, and Richard Carlton said to me, He said, so what did the driver say? And I said to him, the driver said we're going to die. and he said, oh, I thought so. And as we were driving along, we saw this wisp of smoke coming out of something, probably along the lines of this road. We could see these wisps of smoke. And immediately, these men decided to capitalize on this moment. And why is this significant? Because they were looking, and they had been, and this became painfully evident after this event, that they had actually been taking pictures. The story had already been written. They were taking pictures while we were down there to augment, to complement the written story. And so, as we drove up towards where this smoke and this fire was happening, there was a bit of an opening, probably about, may say, 30 or 40 metres back off the road. It looked like something like a mechanical workshop or something like that. It had writing in Albanian and in Serbian on it, and it was on fire. And the fire was raging, in fact. And so they said, tell the driver to stop. And I said, he can't stop here, he can't stop here. And he said, tell him to stop, tell him to stop. I said, he can't. And then he said, stop, stop. And the driver said, no. He said, stop. Of course, he's paying the driver, so the driver had to stop. And they stopped right in front of this building. And the three of them hopped out, raced across to this building, and Richard Carlton, within seconds, was coming back, like, we were talking in the car, we had refreshments, we had food in the car and everything else. He's coming back and saying, the war's been over for a week, and this is what the Serbian forces are doing. And I thought, goodness me. We were horrified, both of us. He got back in the car and I asked his producer, I said, how do you know that the Serbian forces did that? He said, well, who else would have done it? And I said, well, you know, there was writing in two languages up there. That could have been an Albanian-run workshop of some sort. And the Serbs in retreat may have set it on fire, yes. But it also could have been a Serbian-owned workshop, and because this is going to remain Albanian, you know, Albanian territory, maybe the Serb set his own workshop on fire. But then again, maybe a Serb left and the Albanians came along and set it on fire. And of course, they're shooting at each other, so who knows, maybe somebody shot something into this building and there might have been a munitions dump in there. And I gave him at least 14 possible plausible scenarios. And he said, well, he said, do you really think so? And I said, I don't know, and neither do you. And I said, I will be absolutely horrified if you use this, because that just isn't the truth. And of course, there were no flights operating out of Serbia at that time. So we got back to Belgrade and we took the bus to Budapest and we got on a plane and we flew to London. And in the interim, these two had, from a studio in Belgrade somewhere, had edited this material and had already uplifted it and it was out in the ether. And I got to London, where the newspapers, the London Times, which was the format of the old Sydney Morning Herald, this big, had headlines. This is what we went to war for, right? And there were all these pictures of daggers and torture chambers and implements. And the papers were full of this stuff. It was horrific to look at. And I rang my wife and I said, I'm in London. I'll be home soon. And she said, they're already running ads for Sundays, they're going to show this on Sunday. And I said, oh. And I said, how bad does it look? She said, it's terrible. It looks damning. And I said, Richard Carlton is walking away from this building. And then she repeated what I just told you. And of course, they used this. This was the spitz, the spiel, the teaser, so to speak, for the next 3 or 4 days until Sunday night. And then we watched this thing. And it was pretty horrifying. I actually was so disgusted with what they did that I asked them, would you allow me in the coming weeks to keep all of your film footage intact? I won't change one single solitary frame. All of your interviews you did with Albanians and Serbs and whoever else, leave every single one, just let me do the narration. And I'll tell you a completely different story. I can tell the world a completely different story based on the pictures that you've taken. I said, no, you can't do that. And I said, why? said, well, you can't. And then there was nothing I could do. There was nothing fundamental that I could do. We were in a terrible, terrible position. Anyway...
Producer died.
Sorry?
The producer. Saker.
Paul Saker or something? Or Philip Saker. Philip
he
Saker.
Died less than a year after that, and he was in DC. So yeah. Great.
I did not break. This one, it was just the most. Now, the lesson to be learned from this, the lesson to be learned from this is that, you know, when you give an interview to anybody, never go live, never pre-tape an interview, always go live. If you ever get asked to go on television or make a statement, you go live. You never, ever. And Vladik would know that very well because he did this for several years in America when there was no embassy in Belgrade, in America, no Serbian embassy. He ran an office of external affairs of the Serbian church and was de facto the representative of the people in America. So, you know, these people, those media outlets, they're looking for grabs. They want little bits of news that they can string together to tell whatever story they want. Whatever story they want. And they do it. And they do it.
Father, why would you go with them in the first place?
Well, we actually thought that it would be an honourable thing to do to go and get someone to talk to these... Who asked me that question? Because I can't really see very well. Oh, yeah. We went there because we thought it would be honourable to talk to these Australians, because nobody really knew whether Milosevic had incarcerated these guys because they were spies. There were all sorts of stories, and we thought, well, maybe they... And they also told us, look, we want to do an objective report, and they sold us this, you know, we're pretty gullible, pretty stupid, and we believed them. And then we copped it, big time.
Were there any contracts signed or anything like that, or that was just like spoken word and...
I know, it's all spoken word. Yeah, no contracts. No contracts. So, where were we? Globalisation. Back to globalisation. Without the support of global media and the tacit approval of governments might not be anywhere near as effective as this thick-as-thieves network of corporations, governments and media firms is. As corporations grow wealthier and bigger, they swallow up smaller corporations until you arrive at the point we are at today, where news and entertainment are delivered to the world by a handful of mega corporations. Greater influence is vested in fewer agencies. Somebody was telling me this morning, it was you, Petros. You worked for a company that was then bought up by somebody else, and it was bought up by somebody else. Right? This is what happens with big media companies out of the world, and these big corporations. They get sucked up, bought up. Some of them extinguished because they just want to get rid of them. They pay big money for them. Or they incorporate them into their structures, and then they all speak the same language. They all tout the same news. Rupert Murdoch owns almost every local council newspaper in Australia. Did you know that? So your Manly Daily and all those sorts of things, most of those things are owned by Rupert Murdoch, not just the Australian. So as these corporations gobble each other up, fewer voices are heard because only a few stories can be told. And so we are constantly reminded, both here in the USA and elsewhere, that we are blessed to be living in countries where we enjoy free and independent media. How independent can a media corporation be when it is so in bed with a government? How on earth can it be independent? There are mutual interests here, right? Which, unfortunately, nobody seems to be concerned about. As long as it's not formally owned by a government agency, it's not a government media agency, it's an independent one. And we are told that we are to enjoy this because, unlike places like Russia, our media is independent, whereas theirs is state-controlled and state-funded. Well, there's a lot of commotion at the moment around Russia, up in Ukraine. This all sounds very political, but the reason I'm talking about this is very topical, and it's a window into a reality. We'll get into some other things in a moment. I won't keep you here for too much longer. There's a British-based corporate-funded, I don't know where the money comes from, but most of these think tanks are corporate-funded. So I don't know who funds Stratfor in America. They're a huge, hugely influential think tank lobby group in America. And they actually started they came into existence because they actually gathered a group of people together, and they actually lobbied the US government to do what they did in Serbia and in Kosovo. And then since then they've become a hugely influential organisation. Well, there's another one in America, in Britain, called the Heritage Foundation. Notice the emotive significance of the title. It's called the Heritage Foundation. Heritage is a beautiful thing. It's something that we inherit from the past. It's something that's handed down. It's got a nice feeling about it. And then it's a foundation, so we think about foundations as being charitable, about being this and about being that, and offering help and assistance. So it's the Heritage Foundation. And this emotive use of language is done deliberately. And they delivered a statement recently, which runs a couple of pages, but I'm not going to read the whole lot to you. But this is what they came up with. They said, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has highlighted a Russian foreign policy approach that integrates raw military strength with a myriad of soft power tools to pressure adversaries. A key element of Russian soft power is the use of state-sponsored media to influence foreign audiences. Russian propaganda, often masquerading as legitimate news, is disseminated through state-controlled media to confuse, to obscure, and shift the debate about Putin and to legitimise Russian aggression abroad. Russia has used propaganda to shape the battlefield and public opinion in Western democracies. American policymakers and the public should be aware of the pernicious effects of Russian propaganda and take steps to counter its impact. And then they offer a range of measures that America needs to take, and Great Britain, to counter Russian propaganda. So when you're a policymaker in Russia, you're a propagandist. When you're a propagandist in America, you are a policymaker, right? So they're one and the same thing in essence. It's just a very clever use of language, because this is not going to Russia. This is going to out into the ether. It's being downloaded by Western intellectuals, by Western politicians, by Western citizens, who are taking this lock, stock and barrel, because it's coming from England, from the Heritage Foundation, which is a very renowned organisation. And what the Heritage Foundation suggests, because the media is state-run and funded, they actually suggest that the US should take robust steps to counter Russian propaganda and to safeguard Western security and the transatlantic alliance. And in another part of this thing here, they talk about how America, or rather the State Department, needs to put up a whole lot of money, right, to counter this propaganda. So that's state-funded. This is not state-funded. This is state-supported. So that's how it all goes. Now, just as a side on this is another very, very clever and manipulative tactic used by the media, and it relates to this. Have you heard about this guy in America? And his name is Joe Biden. Have you heard about him?
Yes.
Yes, he's probably one of the most unfavourite people amongst Serbs. And I know he's one of Vladika's most unfavourite people.
They know him personally.
And he knows him personally, but he won't talk about that. Before this crisis began, this Russian-Ukrainian crisis began, there was a crisis amongst Ukrainians. Most of the Western world has completely forgotten that there was a crisis in Kiev. And it was between fascists, because the Ukrainians were on the side of the Nazis during the Second World War, and also between the fascists, so these are people who are the hardline sort of neo-Nazis, and also on the other side you had the people who were very strongly influenced by communist ideology and who were very leftist, sort of a very left-wing polity. And there was a huge problem between them. And the legitimately elected government of the Ukraine, which was leftist, was toppled by the fascist. And the government was replaced by a non-elected government. And the Ukraine was not on the brink of a civil war, the Ukraine was in the beginnings of a civil war. And Joe Biden decided, we need to use this situation. So what did he do? He went to the Ukraine and he told the Ukrainians, you have got to liberate yourself of your dependence on Russia for gas. And they said, well, how can we do that? And he said, well, look, you need to liberate yourself from Russia, and that needs to become our focal point. You've got to stop this squabbling amongst yourselves. We've got to liberate you from Russia. And they said, well, how are we going to do this? And I said, well, we'll help you. Who will help you? Well, the American government will help you. And how will it help you? Well, we will help you. We'll help you fund gas exploration in eastern Ukraine, which happens to be where all these Russians live. There are huge deposits of coal seam gas in that whole area. And so he said, we will give you the money to exploit this, and then you'll relieve yourself of your dependence on that. He knew very well what he was doing, because he's actually involved in, and his family is involved in gas and oil exploration in America. That they're mega bazillionaires. And so what he did, he said, look, we'll give you the money, you don't have to worry. And of course the government said, oh, okay, let's get on with it, so let's do what we can do. And then they began this process. Now, in order to facilitate effective management, you couldn't really hand this over to a bunch of Ukrainians who were at war with each other, so you've got to bring somebody in from the outside to do the job. So who do you bring in? You bring in American. But you don't just bring in any American, you bring in your son. And you install him as the president of the board of the biggest gas corporation in the Ukraine, and you pump all your money in there, right? And then the country dissolves into war, and all of a sudden it's all about Russians and Ukrainians. They hate each other and they're fighting over territory, and the whole war has been reduced to a completely different narrative. Nothing to do, in fact, with where this had all started, and nothing to do with its origins at all. This is not conspiracy theory talk. I didn't learn of this on YouTube. And this wasn't delivered by some quack out of some podrum somewhere who dreamt up this incredible story. This was all in the New York Times, and it was also in the Washington Post. The staggering thing about this is this. You know, not everybody in America is stupid. There's a lot of very intelligent people there. In terms of what we're talking about here, in terms of media and media manipulation, the best in the world. So what they did is they let the real story out, but they sanitized it. They sanitized it. And how did they sanitize it? There are a lot of free-thinking people in America. There's a guy called Noam Chomsky, and there's myriads of others who are not necessarily of the same ilk as Noam Chomsky, who's very left-wing. But they were asking, how is it possible that the Vice President of America can install, and it was by virtue of his position that he installed his own son as the President of the Board of the biggest gas concern in the Ukraine? How is that possible? Well, it's very possible. He did it. And then somebody dared ask the question, because you can't ask the Vice President just any question, asked this question. He said, is this or is this not, or does this or does this not represent a conflict of interest? And he said, no. And that was the end of the discussion. And that was in the Washington Post and also in the New York Times. He said no. So everybody decided there was no conflict of interest. You don't go any further. Right? So you don't ask any more questions. So you have told the truth about what's happened, but you have convinced the public. Because don't forget, people work over there. They come home, they're tired, they want to watch reality TV, they might watch some news, they'll get a snippet of this, oh yeah, there was no conflict of interest, it's fine, he knows what he's doing, he does lots of gas and oil exploration in America, that'll be really good for the Ukraine, they'll liberate themselves of their dependency, but they've got no idea what the background story is all about. Another very clever manipulation. So, youth worldwide live in an environment saturated with media. They enjoy increasing access to television, movies, music, games, websites and advertising, often on pocket-sized devices. Given the prominent and growing role that media plays in the lives of our children and adolescents, What effect do these conditions have, first and foremost, on the way they understand themselves in the context of family and the broader society? Without a doubt, one of the most influential people in the world is talk show host Oprah Winfrey. In her shows, she developed a model of interviewing and delivering a message which has been employed by numerous providers of entertainment, from sports panel discussions to cooking shows, from talent quests, the likes of American Idol, to body makeover and beauty shows. In other words, just about every contemporary sports, lifestyle and entertainment offering served up in the mass media. In Christian teaching, the individual exists only in its integral relationship with its creator, its fellow humans, and the remainder of creation. In Oprah land, the individual exists independent of all and everything around it. Nothing truly exists beyond the individual, because the power of the human spirit is such that through it, anything is possible. It is a life-generating force unto itself. Oprah demonstrates her philosophy of thought and of life through a continuous chain of personal stories surrendered by her guests, which over the years have become more and more heartbreaking. Throughout the interview, the guest discloses the most intimate details of their life, the pain and devastation of their life journey, so horrendous that the weeping audience can find no other way of sharing their pain than to burst into rapturous applause time and time again through the impassioned delivery. If you ever watched a comic version of this, if you ever watched the Ellen DeGeneres show, has anybody ever watched the Ellen DeGeneres show? They spent at least 50% of the time clapping. Just, oh, it's so great to be in wherever. They all go crazy because they happen to be from wherever it is, you know, or it's so great to see you. I don't know about clapping and all that sort of stuff. So it's all about this crazy notion of audience interaction, but with Oprah it's much more subtle, and it's much more dangerous. The guest is applauded for their bravery, and the guest, sobbing deeply, cracks a wry or shy smile as he reveals that it's okay. He made it through the power of the human spirit, through self-belief, many times motivated by the host, by Oprah herself. Oprah comforts the guest, identifying with him on just about every level of experience, because she too was raped, was bashed, was bullied, deceived and broken so many times in her life. And they cry together. But that's okay. You can do it, because I did it. And so the individual is exalted, and yet another example of selfish individualism is served up to the young viewer, who begins to see himself in the same way. Everybody's got a story, but their story only is relevant in the context of everybody else's story. In Oprah land, every story is a story on its own, devoid of any relationship with any other person except the perpetrator of a terrible act. So we see gross emotional outpourings, and they have become the mainstay of a huge part of television offerings. You can't underestimate the power of Oprah television. You can't underestimate it, because you can see exactly that model in different applications coming through a whole lot of other programs. So that every contestant in American Idol wants this so bad. And he's right. Everybody wants this so bad, right? The 30 or so finalists are all convinced that they can do it. Because the judges, or whoever it is, it's their coaches, they can say, you can do this. But sadly, only one wins. Sobbing contestants on MasterChef finally uncovered partway through the contest they were born to make omelettes. And nobody will stand in their way of achieving their dream. And so it goes on. Can you imagine how devastating it is for someone to prey upon you in the spirit of contest, right? Often people will go up to, they'll spiel these stories in American Idol, these other shows, these talent quests. I see these things from time to time because my children watch them, much to my disgust. And then sometimes when I'm in foreign countries like Vietnam and China, I watch the Vietnamese or the Chinese version. You don't have to understand the language. It's all the same. Right? It's all the same. It's devastating because somebody was molested as a child or was molested 6 years ago and wasn't able to make an omelette because of that, and now they can make an omelette, and they've been healed, right? Because of this incredibly life-generating experience of being a contestant on MasterChef. Such is the effect of MasterChef on the overwhelming majority of people in the population. Most people cry their eyes out, and it feels such emotion, particularly in Australia, because we're very much, you know, we love the underdog. We love to help the underdog. In America, they're a bit more selective than that. It's very sad, but, you know, that person's on it was better. Sorry, Buster. Okay? So in terms of quality, Americans are much more discerning than Australians generally are. As an aside here, one group of people that MasterChef has had no effect on, or no cooking show, are the children of Father Miodra, because they watch them all, and he has yet ever to see them go to the kitchen and cook anything. And he tells me that on a regular basis. So anyway, the successful idol winner who wins the contest on the same basis as the other 29 lost the contest, because they were all perfect, wonderful, had to have it, you know, just life wasn't worth living without it, goes on, like his omelette-making hero, to become what? What does he become? A celebrity. And then the celebrity is exalted and hailed for much more than their dexterity in handling a microphone, in the case of a singer, or a hand mixer, in the case of the omelette maker. And all of a sudden, he becomes an authority on just about anything. Because celebrities, resplendently dressed by the latest hit fashion guru, they attend launches of new products, for big bucks, of course. Endorsements are very, very lucrative. And just because he is famous, the product mystically gains an added value and consumers rush out to make purchases. And that's particularly evident in fashion. If someone over there in Hollywood wears some particular dress, everybody has to have that dress. And I know, because I've got two daughters getting married this year, I know that when Princess Kate, was it Kate? Yeah. Got married in a lace dress, lace became the fashion, and still is. So lace is what you have to wear, otherwise it's just not fashionable. And you're just not up there. You're just not there. How many of you know or have heard of Angelina Jolie? Who hasn't heard of Angelina Jolie? I believe you. I believe Father Nicola. He has not heard of Angelina Jolie. How many of you know how many breasts Angelina Jolie has? How many breasts does she have?
None.
She removed them. Why did she remove them? Did all of you know that she removed her breasts?
Yes.
Who didn't know that she removed her breasts other than Father Nicola? Okay. So she removed her breasts. And she became world famous for this because she set a trend. Thousands and thousands and thousands of women raced off to surgeons to have their breasts removed because they had a gene that may have resulted in breast cancer at some point, so they wanted them removed. Now, her latest film wasn't doing really well, I'm told. It's actually a good film. It's called Unbroken. I recommend it. Wasn't doing so well, so what did she decide to do? The breasts weren't enough. She had to have her ovaries removed as well. So she was front page news again. That really helped the ratings. So I don't know actually whether she went through with it or not, but she was either going to get her ovaries removed or she did get her ovaries removed. She did get her ovaries removed? Okay. I'm not sure the film did that much better, but she did get on the news in the newspapers. And this is another important thing, which I was going to mention before and I forgot. The things that we're exposed to here, people the world over are exposed to. I just came from China, and on one of my previous trips to China, I noticed the front pages of the newspapers stuck outside the news agency, I guess. And of course, I can't read any of those characters. Couldn't, no idea what's written there. Completely foreign. But the pictures are all Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt and the Kardashians and all that in China. In China. You know? It's really quite remarkable. It's absolutely quite remarkable. The Chinese are fixated with these things, and every voice, every idol, every MasterChef, you have a Chinese variety being broadcast on TV. If it's not a good knockoff, because they do good knockoffs of handbags and jeans and stuff, they do some good knockoffs of TV shows as well. They're actually licensed because they use exactly the same branding and everything else as The Voice or whatever it is. So this is what's happening with these media corporations, because they're working in China, and the trade-off is you want us to invest money over there. Well, we want our television show on your network. So that's how it all works. The fixation of the world with celebrities is perhaps the most worrying and terrifying phenomenon of this mass media age. Celebrities are the icons of society at large. Young people want to look like them, behave like them, emulate them in every respect. And when you have reached a respectable level of likeness to your favourite celebrity, Instagram awaits you. It's a really worrying trend. I'm not really familiar with a whole lot of this stuff, but of all of these things, perhaps the most pernicious that I've seen is Instagram, because people posting pictures of themselves and these selfies. And I was going to buy my daughters a selfie stick when I was in China, but I couldn't find one. Because I just wanted to make fun of this new institution, this new culture institution that comes through Instagram. Because it really is a frightening thing, you know, that complete obsession with self, posting pictures of yourself and wanting to be liked. Not by 3 people, not by 30 people, not by 30,000 people, but by 3 million people. The more likes you can get, the better you are as a person, and you've never met any of them. They know nothing about you. All they know is you look pretty hot. Or whatever the case may be. That's a very frightening, that is a really frightening situation for young people in particular. Because there's no chance that Father Miguel Dragora would go on Instagram. Got nothing much to show.
I might.
So what effects does exposure to media generated values have on the health and well-being of young people? In Pittsburgh, there's a behavioural scientist by the name of Stephen Martino who explored these very issues and shared some interesting research findings on this topic. The more sexual content that kids see on television, the earlier they initiate sexual activity. The more likely they are to regret their early sexual experiences, and the more likely they are to have an unplanned teen pregnancy. There is also a strong causal connection between youth exposure to violence in the media and violent or aggressive behaviour and thoughts. Children are exposed to nearly 300 alcohol commercials per year in the United States. Similarly, more than 80% of movies depict alcohol use. Many Australian Serbian children don't need commercials or movies to be exposed to alcohol consumption. They will see that 365 days of the year, if not in their homes, certainly in the homes of others or in clubs or even in church halls. So, well, the motives movie characters convey for smoking can adversely affect adolescents in real world and adolescents' real world smoking risk. Sexual content on television, on the internet, is not restricted to viewing pornography. I was in Belgrade, I just came back on Thursday, and on my several hours of the day when, you know, I was in the apartment that I was staying in, I flick on the TV and then go through the channels, and you've got your local Serbian television channels, then you have all these satellite programs. And you know, you really know, there's a saying that in Serbian, they "Djavo došao po svoje," or "Vrag došao po svoje," which means the devil's come to collect his own. Which means the situation is really dramatic. There's a television station in Belgrade, for example, and Tutsi is talking about the sexualization of children. There's a television station in Belgrade called Happy Televizija. Right? Happy Televizija screens, for part of the day, screens Certain film with it. Cartoons. So straight after the cartoons finish, for 10 or 15 hours of the day, they have a version of Big Brother, right? Now, Big Brother that you've seen here on television is like watching The Wiggles compared to Puddle, which is the name of this particular program. I watched this for about 5 minutes. I couldn't work out what the dickens was going on. The conversation meant absolutely nothing to me. It's not as if I don't understand serving, but I really did not understand what they were talking about, what the purpose was of this interaction. And I gave it another blast a few hours later. It was so vulgar, and it was in the middle of the day. It was so vulgar. It was so base. And 10 minutes before they had started this, there were cartoons on TV, and little kids were watching, and they could just shift straight into, because it's happy television. Right? Everyone's happy. Right? So this stuff gets through. So I was actually quite disgusted by this, so I changed the channel. And I got to a television channel, because there's about 30 or 40 of these channels. I got to another local Serbian channel, and this was called Zvezdice Granda, the Starlets of Grand. Grand is a TV production house. And you had these young girls, and I watched this. Three contestants, they were aged between the ages of 11 and, say, 13 or 14. And they got up and they sang for a panel of judges, three women and two men, who advised them on their performances. And these girls sang songs that were so, they were beyond suggestive. It was like, you know, when I turn around in bed and touch you, and things like this, coming out of the mouth of an 11-year-old girl. And bouncing around her were 12, you know, three or four 12-year-old girls in shorts and these crop tops, which is not, nothing, there's nothing scandalous about that, but with this particular music and these particular lyrics and this girl trying to emulate the gyrations of one of those pevačica, one of those singers that's popular in Serbia, one of those grotesque characters, right? It was mind-boggling. It was absolutely horrific. And then these judges were giving them pointers on how to do it better. How to do it better. So I was most concerned about this, and then I decided I'd search somewhere else. So I went to Croatian television. Croatian television is generally a cut above Serbian television, to be honest. In terms of its much slicker production, and generally the content is more serious and more intelligent than what a lot of what you see on Serbian. Not this time. There was a reality TV show on there as well. It's all about a family that was in breakdown, and it was total and utter trash of the worst possible kind. I can't impress upon you how bad it really was. So it didn't last very long there. And then I ended up on an American channel, and then that was just too much. That was too much. This was five-year-old girls who were participating in beauty pageants with eyelashes, fake breasts at 5 years of age, and doing whatever it is. You know, I mean, just repulsive. So I thought, get up, go downstairs. There's a great cafe downstairs, made great porcini collage. So I went downstairs and had a black coffee and a porcini collage just to recover from this assault. Right? Because being the father of four daughters, and also being a parish priest for many years, and looking at children in your own parish and your family and your friends and everything else, I mean, and then you're looking at your nation. You know, I kind of feel like I'm part of something bigger than my, a little community like we are here. You're part of a nation when you're in Serbia. I was really devastated. I was absolutely devastated. And I thought, where is this world going, and what values is it imbuing in our children? So what can a concerned parent do? They can restrict how much media their children, particularly young children, consume. This may mean limiting television hours or internet access. This isn't always easy, especially for older teens who have smartphones, who have easy access to the internet all the time, who have friends who have access to these things as well. The key then is establishing clear lines of communication between children and parents. Most of you are here. Indeed, my relationship with my children functions in terms of discussing things that are difficult to discuss. It's a lot easier for me to do so than my parents with me when I was growing up. You just didn't talk about anything. So But it's very important that you do. Mind you, I'm not one of these people that thinks that you need to go into infinitesimal detail about absolutely everything. I remember Metropolitan Amfilochia of Synagora said to me that he was in America once, and he was just a monk in those days, and he was in some town, and a very wealthy Serbian man came up to him and said, explained that he and his wife had just had a child about 2 months ago, and he was very high up in banking. He made lots and lots of money and whatnot. And he said to him, you know, Father, I've done everything I can possibly think of for this child. We awaited this child with such anxiety and such anticipation. And he said, I've done everything. I've paid for I've put all the money away for his entire education, for his college education, which is a significant amount of money in America. We've got a beautiful home. We've fixed up his room. We've bought every mod con. We've done absolutely everything. And he said, and I still feel that there's something I could do for my child. I said, there's something in there. There's something that I feel that I can still do for that child. And he said, well, there is. And he said, what is it? He said, love your wife. Petros. And I know Petros for a long time from Adelaide. And he, like most of us, he had his little trials and tribulations. But really, how important is it for a husband to love his wife? A wife to love her husband? You know, a lot of questions your kids are going to ask you will come as a result of a failed relationship between you and your husband or you and your wife. If your relationship is whole, if it's loving, if it's trusting, if it's tender, this will answer a whole lot of questions that will actually never ever be asked, because they won't become issues. It's when children are faced with failed relationships, when they have no role models, that they actually begin to become confused and they seek to find an answer. So keep that in mind. It's the most important thing that you can do is to love your wife or love your husband, as long as you're a woman. This can be frightening and a daunting prospect for even the most confident of parents. We should be increasingly disturbed by messages conveyed through television programs, websites, advertising, movies, books, billboards, magazines, and video games. All of these have the power to shape how boys and girls think about themselves and the values by which they may choose to live. We need to pay closer attention to what our children listen to and view if we are to effectively counter or moderate media influence. I sat down with my youngest daughter, Ileana, a couple of years ago, and we went through the top 40 and we listened to snippets of each song. Because I had to go through a learning experience. I thought she'd be the best person to walk me through this. It was horrific. It was absolutely horrific. The messages that were being delivered were not only immoral, but they were absolutely, there's just no way that you could substantiate any of the claims that they make, particularly the one that was made by is it Pink or is it Lady Gaga, who said some song about you were born this way.
No,
is that Lady Gaga? Okay. So, and I thought to myself, but Miss Pink, or whatever her name is, she had another song that was about on the same theme, right? And it was astonishing because, you know, there isn't one shred of scientific evidence. No history, no National Geographic or Discovery Channel is ever going to tell you that there is one shred of evidence, scientific evidence, that can substantiate that claim that people are born of a certain sexual orientation. But they get away with it, and they actually form these impressions and understandings in young minds about the, well, Pink said so, or whoever it was, Lady Gaga said so, and she was popular and everyone loves her, and we all went to the music shows or whatever that was, and you know, so it must be okay. Youths who most frequently visit websites depicting real people fighting, shooting or killing were 5 times more likely to report engaging in assaults, stabbings, robberies and other violent behaviour than those who never visited violent sites, concludes this famous psychologist. On a more subtle level, we need to be mindful of efforts to exploit our children for profit. Marketers hire psychologists to research what children want and what they respond to. These marketers want to create brand loyalty amongst shoppers starting at a very young age. Now, as the father of four daughters, I was always mystified. How was it that at the age of two, having never seen a McDonald's, when Dushanka saw her first McDonald's, she screamed with joy, right? And why did she always want to go back there? How was this designed so that, such that she and all other children from a very early age had this incredible need to go to McDonald's to consume those products? That did pass, actually, at one point. I remember going to Canberra with a friend who had three or four children. We were in a big tarago, and all the kids wanted to go, all seven or eight of them wanted to go to McDonald's somewhere on the line. And I said to my children, I said, no, we haven't got any money. We can't go. And Dushanka said to me, I have money. And she had $100 and that she'd gotten for her birthday or something. So we decided we'd go to McDonald's. But I made her pay. She was devastated when she realised this cost $70-something, right? And she was left with 30 of her 100. Only, you know, when she understood that that was the only way she would ever understand that this cost her that money. And it was a lot of money. If I was paying for it, we would have ordered double quantities of it. So, researchers found that marketers use advertising to promote these three messages to girls. Looks matter above all else. Thin and sexy is the ideal. Boyfriends and shopping should be the centre of their attention. What we have learnt of late is that messages emphasising sexuality can stunt development of other interests and involvements. Again, I remember when my kids were small, if you went to the beach, you walk down to Maruba Beach, there was a truck down there that was handing out syringes one weekend so that drug addicts wouldn't be infecting themselves with dirty syringes. And the next weekend they were handing out condoms. And then the billboards were replete with these images of women who'd been bashed, and it was say no to domestic violence, right? And domestic violence used to be abhorred, but painting a picture of every man as a possible assailant, as a rapist, as a transferor of disease, as a drug addict, and everything negative, and you know, is a terrible thing to have delivered to your children. Terrible thing, because it distorts their perception of men in particular. And it just happens that almost all of the issues that were going to be influencing children at that time, and this is still a problem now, were of a sexual nature. Everything somehow came down to sex. Media messages strategically target boys as well. By often portraying boys as rebellious and out of control, media reinforce sullen, surly and aggressive behaviour. Males who view sexual material, not just pornography, tend to be significantly more accepting of aggression against women than those who do not. So somebody said. Both genders need parents, church and community leaders and teachers to model, teach and encourage standards. It is important, but not enough, to advocate for improved quality of television programming and to place reasonable restrictions on TV viewing and movie choices. So you can devote your whole life now to going out and collecting signatures, going up and down the street and doing all those kinds of things, and some people can afford to do that. But what ends up happening is if you end up becoming an activist in this field, you're not going to get very far, and what's going to happen is the area where you can actually make the most difference, and that's in your home, and your own family, will suffer because you're not there to deliver the support, the teaching, the love, the care, and all those other positive qualities. Most of all though, our children need persuasive communication from us, accompanied by good questions to help them process what they observe. Overt criticism and harsh judgments may simply cause them to rebel and reactively defend their viewing and listening choices. Overt criticism and harsh judgments. Sounds like a very Serbian family. Lots of overt criticism and harsh judgments. Somebody said to me that child abuse for Serbian families is basically just what was the word? What do they call it?
Normality.
It was just discipline. Child abuse and discipline. Does that mean the same thing? So instead of lecturing or ranting, reduce it to a short sentence. Look your teen in the eye, say it, and stop. In other words, don't harp on, don't nag. Rather than doing all the talking to try to drive your point home, listen respectfully and reflectively to your children's responses. Ask good questions to encourage critical thinking. Churches and congregations can help counter negative influences. This is possible not only through effective program for youths, but also by offering training and support for parents in our parishes. Strong, healthy families can help youths resist the lure of instant gratification, materialism, and selfish individualism. Parent groups can provide communication and conflict management skills training. They can also strengthen parents through peer support. Even more than programming, though, the relationships youths experience with Christian adults, other than their own parents, may most powerfully influence their values and behaviour. Thus, the importance of the real sense of the community. One of the most powerful motivators for sexual abstinence is a positive view of marriage as a worthy goal and source of happiness. Congregations can promote such a view by affirming and celebrating marriage. They can provide supports for healthy marriages and families by equipping parents and other adults to grow their own relationships and serve as good role models. Given the amount of time our children are exposed to television, advertising, movies, popular music, websites and video games, we can ill afford to ignore the messages they are receiving. We probably cannot ever completely eliminate such influences. We can, however, counter them with compelling alternative points of view. Within the context of relationship education, the church can use media to explore what makes relationships healthy and invite teens to discuss and assess how television programs portray dating and marriage relationships. Use movies as springboards for discussions about relationship choices and consequences. Adults also might well assess the impact of media on their own moods, attitudes and behaviour. In addition to sharing Christian perspectives and values directly with youths, we must equip parents, teachers and other adults to listen carefully, speak clearly and encourage critical thinking.
So, dear listeners, we were listening to the presentation of Father Radar Adams from Sydney, Australia, on mass media and today's youth. I hope you enjoyed this very interesting speech. Thank you and good night. Thank you for listening Radio Svetigora, the radio station of the Serbian Orthodox Church, Diocese of Montenegro and the Seaside. Blessed by His High Eminence, Metropolitan Amfilohije.